Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up on Word of Mouth, big data at the box office. Hollywood's newest mad scientist is a statistician who evaluates scripts based on audience data and analysis of proven successes. Also today, the daring artistry and mechanical wizardry of 19th century Victorian walking canes. But first, Jane Austen, game theorist.
We each have an unsocial, taciturn disposition, unwilling to speak unless we expect to say something that will amaze the whole room.
This is no very striking resemblance of your own character, I'm sure.
A bit of the smoldering chemistry there between Mr. Darcy and Elizabeth Bennet, played by Colin Firth and Jennifer Ely in the BBC's 1995 adaptation of Pride and Prejudice. This year marks the 200th anniversary of publication of Jane Austen's most celebrated novel, in which Miss Bennet discovers her true love in a man she first thought of as a conceited adversary. Austen's novels have inspired countless film and TV adaptations and fan clubs and even monster and zombie parodies. A new addition to the study of all things Austen is Jane Austen, Game Theorist. It's written by UCLA political scientist Michael Che. The book proposes that Austen laid the philosophical groundwork for the theory of strategic action known as game theory. Here to help us understand is Jennifer Schussler of the New York Times. She recently wrote about the book. Jennifer, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Hi, Virginia.
Well, before we jump into this new look at Jane Austen, how about a quick primer on game theory?
Well, game theory is the quantitative science of strategic thinking. It is commonly seen as having been founded by the Cold War mathematician and strategist John von Neumann in 1944 with his book Theory of Games and Economic Behavior. And basically the idea here is that game theory looks at the way people act to maximize their own interests, not thinking just about what they want and how they're going to get it, but thinking also about what their opponent wants, what their opponent is going to do first, and what their opponent thinks they're going to do. And this is a very math-heavy discipline. It's sort of been adopted all over the place. But I have to say, I do think that Michael Che is the first person to apply it to literature.
Popular culture, a lot of people may have heard of game theory from John Forbes Nash of A Beautiful Mind fame.
But exactly.
I'm wondering, like, which disciplines use game theory?
Well, it's really all over the place. I mean, you can read biologists who will look at it to study the way predator and prey interact with each other, and when for instance, when a lion decides it's worth it to chase a gazelle. It's huge in political science, Professor Che's discipline, where it's somewhat controversial. Not everybody appreciates the way it sort of assigns numbers to everything and then looks at everything from the way protest movements unfold to nuclear brinkmanship, this kind of thing. People also use it to look at stock market trading, all sorts of things. So it's really all over the place. But again, I think Che's really a pioneer in trying to apply it in a quite hard-headed and specific way to Jane Austen.
How did he become interested in Jane Austen?
He told me, I believe he's in his late 40s, that until about maybe 7 or 8 years ago, he had never read Jane Austen. And it was family movie night. He sat down with his kids to watch Clueless, you know, the kind of great
right.
90s
Emma
movie.
Adaptation.
Exactly. Alicia Silverstone. And he, you know, what he said to me is, you know, I was really amazed. You know, this movie was entirely about manipulation. You know, he had always thought it was a big mathematical thing. But, you know, he realized that people had been thinking about strategic manipulation in a kind of very detailed way for a long time, and that Jane Austen seemed to have an unusually acute understanding. So he said he sat down, he read all the novels, he started reading all sorts of literary criticism, and then he really did his homework, and he came up with this quite math-heavy book, which I should be clear is aimed very much at his fellow political scientists.
Well, I was wondering about that. It's full of diagrams and things, isn't it?
Exactly. I don't want to stomp on anybody's book sales, but I do think that your average Jane Austen fan might want to wait for the movie version of Jane Austen Game Theorist, because it's a little bit tough going,
well,
but very interesting.
He goes so far as to claim that Austen is the uncredited founder of game theory. Now, why does he think she was using it or maybe even created it?
To be clear, he doesn't argue that she knew what game theory was or, you know, had this name for it or anything, but just that she is, you know, one of the uncredited founders, because he thinks that she was very deliberately looking at strategic action. And he identifies, I believe it's something like 50 separate strategic manipulations, many of which are not even really central to the plots. And what he says is, look, she wouldn't have included some of this stuff in these books if she wasn't kind of trying to work out these problems. And one quite interesting aspect of this is he claims that she didn't merely anticipate some things that people like John von Neumann and others went on to develop, but she actually developed some insights that other people have so far failed to equal or replicate. For example, he offers this concept which he calls cluelessness, which isn't just a funny play on the title of the movie, but he thinks this is actually a concept that Austin understood that is sort of ignored by contemporary game theorists.
We're talking about Jane Austen as game theorist. That's the subject of a new book by UCLA political scientist Michael Che. Our guest is New York Times writer Jennifer Schussler, who's written several stories about Jane Austen on this 200th anniversary year, including a piece about this idea. Well, I was thinking that, you know, you mentioned Clueless is the name of the film, which was an adaptation of Austen's Emma. But there's a scene in Pride and Prejudice, and we're going to play a scene from the 2000 film adaptation of it. Keira Knightley here as Elizabeth Bennet, Dame Judi Dench as Lady Catherine de Bourgh.
Has my nephew made you an offer of marriage?
Your ladyship has declared it to be impossible.
Let me be understood. Mr. Darcy is engaged to my daughter. Now what have you to say?
Only this, if that is the case, you can have no reason to suppose he would make an offer to me.
You selfish girl! This union has been planned since their infancy. Do you think it can be prevented by a young woman of inferior birth? Now tell me once and for all, are you engaged to him?
I am not.
And will you promise never to enter into such an engagement?
I will not, and I certainly never shall.
So how does that demonstrate the strategy of cluelessness, Jenny?
To be clear, what Elizabeth Bennet is doing in that scene is she is refusing to promise that she will never get engaged to Mr. Darcy. And what Che argues is that Lady Catherine de Bourgh here is being what he calls clueless, because what happens is sometimes a stronger party in an interaction with a weaker party doesn't really think it has to take that weaker party seriously. So it doesn't think that that weaker party might actually be very cleverly trying to manipulate the stronger party. So what Lady Catherine de Bourgh doesn't really realize is that she will go back to Mr. Darcy and say, that insolent Elizabeth Bennet, she refused to promise that she wouldn't marry you, that this shows that she doesn't know her place, etc. But what Lady Catherine de Bourgh doesn't realize is that she has indirectly passed along a signal to Mr. Darcy, which suggests to him that Elizabeth is still interested in him, even though she has claimed to him she is not. So Che doesn't quite say that Lizzie is doing this consciously or deliberately, but effectively that's what happens. So because of Lady Catherine's cluelessness, Elizabeth is able to advance her own cause.
Jennifer Schussler writes about books and culture for the New York Times. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Virginia.
We do have a link to her article and more on Michael Che's book, Jane Austen, Game Theorist. That's all on our Facebook page. We've also posted some videos that we found worth sharing, an animated adaptation of Pride and Prejudice in just 2 minutes, and some memes paying tribute to the BBC series, including a famous scene that made Colin Firth's career. I'll just say it. It involves him going swimming in a shirt. We may associate canes with old age and physical decline, but 150 years ago, the cane held a much more dashing and flamboyant place among the fashionable set. Wildly decorated and splendidly diverse, canes were associated with prestige and power and youth, and were extremely trendy. The demand for canes made of allspice wood nearly drove the West Indian trees into extinction. Here to discuss the 19th century version of 22-inch rims is Wayne Curtis. He's a freelance journalist who's written for The Atlantic, Preservation, and Down East magazines. We found his recent article, Pimp My Walk, on the Smart Set blog. Wayne, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Happy to be here.
So what a funny thing to write about. Are you a collector of canes?
I'm not at all, in fact. I've been working on a book about the history of walking in America, and I kept coming across references to canes, people using them even though they were completely healthy and fit. And then I got really intrigued when I came up with an auction catalog from an auction that was held in Tennessee. It had an amazing selection of canes. They did incredible things. They sort of seemed like the Swiss Army knife of the 19th century. They just had all sorts of tricks and quirks.
Well, tell us a little bit about those. Some of the canes popular in the 19th century were, as you said, a lot of gadgets, but were quite racy.
They were. They're what I consider porn canes. They they had all sorts of interesting graphics of men and women involved in various positions. Sometimes they were done artistically so that you wouldn't be able to tell what was going on unless you examined it closely. Sometimes it was done surreptitiously so that you had to open up a knob or a ball on top to see the pornographic scene in it. Some of the other ones were had little buttons and levers and things that caused scenes to unfold on the cane top, which probably shouldn't be discussed in polite company, but there was a whole subset of these pornographic canes as well.
Did canes serve any other purpose than a walking aid?
I'm not even sure they served much of a purpose as a walking aid when they were being used back then. It seemed to be more of a stature aid. Canes were started out really as symbols of power. It would have been something like a scepter that the royalty had at the outset, and then minor nobility would have embraced fancy canes as being something similar. When you held a cane in your hand, you couldn't be doing any manual labor. It showed that you were somebody who was above all that. Canes were pretty elaborately bejeweled and decorated. I know even in the late 19th century, in the later iteration, that Fabergé made canes, Tiffany made canes. They were really showpieces at the time. From the nobility, it went down to the upper class, and then it sort of wandered into the middle class. They wanted to have canes as well to show that they were people of some means. And then I think they started becoming a little bit more clever. And even if you were a tradesman, you could have canes that did things that aided you in your work.
Meaning maybe there'd be some sort of tool end or hook or gaff or something on them?
They did everything. Some of them had a complete picnic utensil set in them. You could open it up and it had knife and fork hidden away in there. There were opera glasses attached to the top, ear trumpets. One had a perfume bottle. There was a winemaker's thermometer in one, telescopes, flask in there. You could keep your liquor in there. It had a cork top that would slide out of the shaft of the cane. Sewing kits, compact and mirror. One had a full-length saw blade you would connect between the curved end of the cane and the tip so you could cut trees while you were out walking. Penny whistles. There's one that had a set of watercolors and a paintbrush hidden inside of it. And then more practical things, just like gauges for someone who might want to know the height of a horse in hands. You could pull that, slide out a gauge and measure the horse and then slide it back into your cane and continue on. And we haven't even gotten into weaponry yet.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because they are sticks at the, you know, they're truncheons at the heart of it all. Were they used as weapons?
Consider all the wild dogs that were running around at the time. I think it was probably a sensible thing to have a cane, particularly when you're walking in a city. You didn't know what was going to be coming up at you from around the next corner. Petty thieves and kids who might be coming out trying to pickpocket you. A cane would be a handy thing, just as a shillelagh, as a truncheon to keep people away. But they were also outfitted to do other things. Quite a few were made up with guns built into them. Flip a couple buttons and a trigger would emerge, and you might have a single bullet in the tip. There was one account I saw of a man walking with a friend through the countryside. He, at one point, just lifted his cane up and dropped a partridge, you know, some yards away, and went over and collected it and said the cane was handy because people didn't feel threatened by it as they would if you were walking around with a rifle, and also it allowed him to poach much more effectively without being caught.
When did canes start to go out of fashion?
About concurrent with the rise of the automobile. Canes were still pretty prevalent in the early part of the 20th century, 1910, 1920. There were still canes as there were hats. But then they started to fade sometime around then. And I think that was really reflecting the fact that they were stature objects at the time. It was much more stature to have a Packard or some other kind of automobile to go around. You no longer needed the cane anymore because when you were out and about, you showed who you were by the wheels that you drove, not by the cane that you carried. So walking culture died out and driving culture came in.
So the boulevardiers of yesteryear carried these beautiful canes. And now I'm a little saddened when I think of the canes that I've seen now, those kind of aluminum things with rubber tips and sometimes 4 feet on the bottom of them, which I know are very, very useful, but not very dapper.
They aren't very dapper. Although I did find a website which allows you to customize your aluminum cane with neon-colored tips for them and other accessories. And it is a little sad to see that it's faded. However, I also find it a little bit sad to see that canes might be coming back in certain circles. I did a little bit of Googling on it and found out that, say, some of the Kardashian entourage are now fancying themselves carrying walking sticks. And I was thinking, oh, that's not right.
Can a young nigga get money anymore? Tell Peter my mink is dragging on the floor. Can I have a bag?
Wayne Curtis, freelance journalist and writer. He's the author of the book And a Bottle of Rum. It's the history of the New World in 10 Cocktails. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
It was more than the music in the projects one day. The project one way we done heard all that.
Coming up, the edge of America. A Boston Globe reporter subjects himself to the oddities of America's recreational habits for a new travel show. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. You do it. We fly.
ride in the parakeet, floating with no parachute, $6,000 parachute. We made it to the Paris News.
Word of mouth.
Are you ready?
All I can think is, Jeff, don't drop the pig.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott, and that's a clip from The Edge of America, a new show from the Travel Channel that explores America's recreational fringe. It's an experiential survey of some of the bizarre, dangerous, and hilarious things that people do to have fun all over this country. Jeff Edgers is the host and writer for the program, and when he's not jousting bicycles or eating God knows what, he's an arts and culture reporter for the Boston Globe. Jeff, great to have you with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, so what was happening in that clip that we just heard? Why did you mean don't drop the pig?
That's the Pig and Ford race, which is in Tillamook County, Oregon. I mean, it's easy to describe. It's just hard to make it sound sensible. The race involves you start on the side. The gun goes off. You run, grab a live pig from a pen, then run back to this Model T, crank it, get it going, get in the Model T while holding the live pig, race around the track a lap, stop your car, go back, exchange your live pig for another live pig, and go back and do another lap. So that's the Pig and Ford race.
So how'd you do? Did you drop the pig?
I did not drop the pig, though I did not win. I actually rode shotgun because, frankly, holding the pig wasn't that hard. Figuring out how to drive the Model T at the same time as I was holding the pig, you know, I didn't want to hurt anyone, myself, the pig, or the Model T.
Well, so this has offered you a lot of experiences, a bit of a departure, I guess, from, what, covering the Boston Symphony Orchestra?
There are some things that are cosmically similar. You know, as a reporter, I've always wanted to find interesting stories and characters and things outside the mainstream. And that's why I became an arts reporter and not somebody who covered, you know, politics or sports. That said, my job at the newspaper is to stay out of the story. And my job in this travel show is to explore, but also become part of it and to, you know, enter it.
Well, I have to say, in our statistically correct survey of four people on our staff, we decided that hosts of experiential programs on the Travel Channel and Food Network have the best jobs. Any truth to that?
It's very possible. And what I love about my job, frankly, is there's such variety in our show. You know, for example, like Bizarre Foods, which is a huge popular show on Travel Channel, that involves eating bizarre foods every episode. Well, for me, it's like, as you know, I've eaten some things I didn't want to eat during the show. But that's just one little element. And you might have to eat something that you don't want to eat, but then like five episodes can go by without, you know, having that happen. I mean, even now we're filming in Minnesota at one of the coldest towns. You know, it's like a physical ice box. You know, we filmed in Florida earlier this year, in Oklahoma and Arkansas and Oregon. So the beauty of this show for me is the variety. You know, you can do all sorts of different things in all sorts of different places.
All right, I'm going to get back to that squirm-worthy eating experience. Now, before this clip plays on YouTube, comes a warning that some viewers might find it disturbing, but I think it's a little more palatable without the image. Let's hear it.
That's a nice one.
Is he happy?
He is loving it.
Will you just tell me if this isn't going the way it's supposed to? Because it seems like it is.
It is going wonderful.
Yeah?
Wonderful.
Okay. And I'm not the first person to do this here, right? This has been going on a little while?
Probably 200-300 years.
Three centuries earlier, cowboys would castrate the calves to mellow them out. They also didn't want to waste the leftovers, so they'd fry up testicles. I get it. Today, Darren fries up 2,000 pounds of testicles for the popular calf fry.
This is the part we're going to eventually eat tomorrow, right?
Yes.
This,
yeah.
Right there.
Yeah.
Nice. All right. He seems angry.
He's not me.
Okay, that's a clip of our guest Jeff Edgers from an episode of The Edge of America. It's a new show on the Travel Channel. So, Jeff, I'm trying to piece together what's going on there. Can you maybe fill us in?
Well, I'll just be up front. I mean, I castrated a bull in the first episode. I don't know how else to say it.
There kind of isn't another way, but I had to actually turn my head away from this watching it. How about you? Is there an option of you saying
you're not the only one?
Well, can you say to your producers?
Talk to my wife.
I don't want to castrate a calf. I just don't want to do it.
Well, I don't think you have to. I'm doing it. You know, I mean, here's the thing. The question on this show is, you know, a lot of TV shows, they might show a calf fry. You know, they call it Rocky Mountain Oyster in Colorado. They might show a host like, oh, hey, this is a bull testicle. Then you take a bite of it. you know, and it's deep fried, and it's, you know, it's like almost like a piece of zucchini if it's cut thin enough, you know, and you're sitting there and you make a funny face and that's it. But this show's a little different. And the fact is, if this thing is so popular and it's been going on for so long and it's rooted in the history of Oklahoma, I want to go one step beyond and get under the surface. And so that's why I found myself in the middle of this field with this cowboy, basically doing something that couldn't be further from what I feel comfortable doing.
It's so funny because you pull up in your Prius to that pasture.
Thank you. Thank you for noticing. He didn't really like that Prius or my John Fluvog shoes. But you know what? I did the deed, you know? And you know, you played a clip that, I mean, it's kind of like light feeling in that part, but as you know from watching it, like, it was not an easy experience for me. I know physiologically what's going on there, but in the moment, I stopped thinking, you know? I was like, what? Oh, my God, you know? I mean, it's, I don't like blood.
Well, I realize that there is, for on my part, some cultural relativism going on. I mean, I didn't grow up on a ranch eating fried bull cojones, but what do you think the effect is there? I mean, what's the squirm factor versus exposing audiences to other cultures? What's your sort of approach?
Well, the thing about this show is it really is, as I said, defined by the place you're in. And it's a little bit brutal in spots, you know, the castration. There's a rattlesnake derby, which isn't really brutal, but is, you know, a little bit in the horror movie realm. But then our Oregon episode, it's got a totally different feel, I think. You know, I'm doing this bike jousting with these crazy punk rock guys. I'm climbing trees, the pig and Ford race. So whether it's good or bad, I mean, just other people are going to have to define that. But I feel like the show is driven by what's taking place in that region. I mean, you wouldn't have a calf fry in Boston. You just wouldn't. You know, in the same way at the Rattlesnake Derby, you're eating rattlesnake, and I'm saying, I'm eating rattlesnake, and the guy says, well, you know, it's like any reptile. He starts ticking off the list of things. I mean, I've never eaten frog legs. I've never eaten a turtle. And at some point, I mentioned to him something about clams or oysters, and he was like, oh, that's disgusting. Really?
Well, do you find some regions of the U.S., like when you're looking out over what you want to cover, are there some places that are more, what, colorful than others?
I'll tell you, I mean, I'd love to go in with some kind of stereotype about what's going to be active and exciting. But what I've found really is people make their own fun. Mm. So if you're going to a place like Arkansas, which seems kind of deadly dull, it's not. I mean, there are some amazing festivals there. And in many cases, like one of our harder episodes to do was New York, because there's so much mainstream stuff. So many people who want to spend like $700 to go to a Rolling Stones concert, you know, and so many sports teams that it was harder to find things that were offbeat and different and like exciting. When you go to a lot of these other, you know, states that seem to are like sort of pompous, stuck up Northeastern sensibilities to be, you know, boring, they're not at all. I mean, I loved Arkansas. You know, I loved Louisiana and not even the part that involved New Orleans. Mm. And I loved, you know, Oklahoma. I got to tell you, I felt like I was in a totally foreign territory and I felt like I got to understand it a little bit better.
Well, let's play a scene from another scene from The Edge of America. You mentioned bike jousting in Portland, Oregon. Let's have just a clip of that.
What is it about this place that makes you do this?
Keeping it freaky.
Keeping it freaky, okay, yeah?
We're more fun than a lot of the rest of the country,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah. Fun or stupid, I want it. So what do I need to do this?
Don't fall off your bike.
Can you get hurt from it?
Yeah, you'll be fine, I'm sure.
Thanks, guy in crutches.
That's a scene of a bicycle jousting competition in Portland, Oregon, from the show The Edge of America. Jeff Edgers is with us. He is the host and writer for the show and a longtime arts writer for the Boston Globe. Why, Jeff, do you think, you know, you've got a couple of miles and events behind you. Why do you think so many forms of American recreation do involve this risk to life and limb?
Well, there's something about adrenaline, you know. I mean, it's why do we go skiing, you know? Why do we play basketball? Why, you know? Why do we go to like rock concerts with like the, you know, the energy that you have there, or like, you know, or go to see something at Symphony Hall? I mean, there's something about the adrenaline fueled energy that goes on in that. And, you know, with a lot of these events that we're covering, it's almost like childhood. I mean, I don't know what you did when you were a kid, but like when I was a kid and like 10 years old, we would have our bikes and we'd make little jumps, or we'd tie sleds to the bikes and put like buckets of water on them. We'd invent all sorts of crazy stuff to do that, you know, technically, you know, is not in the, you know, parenting handbook, but it was just fun. And, you know, what I love about this bike jousting is it's ridiculously stupid in many ways, but super fun.
And great to watch. I don't know if you're ever going to go back to a desk job, are you?
Yeah, like today. I mean, I'm a full-time staff writer at the Boston Globe. You know, I'm, you know, interviewing conductors on my phone, and then I'm heading out and skiing down a mountain with a Viking like 2 hours later. That's the job right now.
Well, Jeff Edger, it's a pleasure talking with you, and best of luck with the show.
Thanks very much.
Statistician and blogger Nate Silver proved the power of predictive statistics during election 2012. Having conquered politics and created affinity analytics on Amazon and Netflix and dipped a toe into social media, data crunchers are moving on to another high-stakes challenge, Hollywood.
Here's Johnny!
Brooks Barnes is a media reporter for the New York Times. He recently wrote about Vinnie Brizzesi. He's a statistician and former professor who's using big data to slice and dice Hollywood screenplays. Brooks, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, script doctors are Hollywood staples. We've heard about deflated screenwriters mourning what the studios did to their art. How is Vinnie's approach different?
Right. Those folks have always been around, kind of working in the shadows. What Vinny is doing, who was described to me as one client as the reigning mad scientist of Hollywood, some think more mad than scientist, what he's doing is trying to apply data to the script, looking at genre and plot points and comparing that to movies that have come before and saying this similar movie had this type of box office open, but if you change these elements, perhaps you could have this type of box office result.
Any specific tweaks that Vinny may suggest after crunching through the script and the numbers?
Horror is one area that he gave me a bunch of examples in, and he talks about a demon in a horror movie can either target people or be summoned by something. And according to his research, the ones that are targeting have much higher opening weekend. If it's summoned, people aren't as interested, and so his quote is, get rid of that Ouija board scene.
So is there enough data, since this is all about data after all, to suggest if Vinny's evaluation techniques have succeeded or failed?
Well, there are reasons to take this guy seriously, as wacky as it sounds, and as much as the writers, capital W, in Hollywood are not happy with this idea. He's the CEO of a company called Worldwide Motion Picture Group, and for about 10 years, it's been one of the leaders in developing focus group practices to tell studios how their movies or nearly finished movies should be tweaked to play with the audience. So what he's doing is taking box office results that are available to everyone, but also looking at his own proprietary databases to say, okay, well, all of our testing on this other movie predicted this, and we were right, so you should perhaps take what we're saying here seriously.
Here's one script that went through Vinny's evaluation, in an early draft anyway. This is from Oz the Great and Powerful, which has now raked in close to $500 million worldwide, starring James Franco as Oz, Zach Braff as the voice of Finley, the flying monkey.
How hard could it be to kill a wicked witch?
Hard! Really hard! It's very, very hard to kill a wicked witch. And what about that poor girl back there? I think she really liked you.
She'll get over me. They always do.
So, say his valuation comes away with the protagonist has to have a dopey sidekick. I mean, can we expect right. every new release to have a dopey sidekick? Are moviegoers so predictable, Brooks?
The thing is that they kind of are in some way, you know, as much as we would like to think that we're not. And this is about a very a specific type of movie. It's not, you know, the Oscar movies. It's not a serious dramas. These are big commercial movies designed to play to a global audience. And so that's important to remember. The other thing is that it was very difficult to get details in terms of what his specific advice for movies is and has been. For Oz, for example, I was only able to find out and verify that they were hired to look at it. But in terms of what the suggestions were and whether or not those specific ones were carried out, we're not really sure. So the point is that they do this analysis. The idea is for then the writers and producers to take it or leave it. You know, we can use part of it, we can use all of it, we can say, you know, Vinny's nuts. we know better.
Another Hollywood illusion shattered. Brooks Barnes, yeah. Media reporter with the New York Times, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Now you can link to Brooks's article, Solving Equation of a Hit Film Script with Data, at wordofmouthradio.org. And I got to tell you, this Vinny is a terrific character. It's worth reading. If you spend any time in the town of Sandwich, New Hampshire, you may have picked up on its mix of preserved antiquity and progressives. Sandwich may be yesterday on the outside, but it's tomorrow on the in. As Sean Hurley reports, the contrasting elements come together on the town's soccer field a few days before the annual Sandwich Fair. So while many towns regard carnies as riffraff or invaders, residents of Sandwich welcome them as competitors.
The great unfolding town of Sandwich loomed with mountains, damp with lakes and rivers, and free of excess roads. Each year hosts the Sandwich Fair, which includes geese, monkeys, lumberjacks, music, food, games, the legendary Art Harriman, and of course, thrilling rides like the Typhoon, the Twist, and everyone's favorite, the Gordello of Blood. While a lot of the vendors and animal keepers are local, the rides are operated by Gillette Shows. Most of the Gillette workers are from Veracruz in the central part of Mexico, right on the Gulf. Of the 30 or so Mexican workers this year, Ali Morales, the crew foreman, is one of the few who speaks English.
So we are traveling in America, Massachusetts, New York, Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont. And, well, we have been making friends like you guys from here. Nice people, so we are trying to have fun, and that's it. We are working on the fair. Turn up and turn down with the rice.
So you set everything up and take it all down. And you also operate things?
Mine is the Twist.
About 7 years ago, this set-up-tear-down routine was interrupted. Sandwich resident Ashley Bullard tells the story.
We have been playing soccer for about 10 or 12 years here on Sundays. And about 6 or 7 years ago, these guys... Goal! Yeah! These guys were walking around and passed our game and asked us if we wanted to play them.
These guys were the Mexican fair workers. The following year, Ashley and Jeff Hoosman roamed about the half-erected grounds to see if their Mexican friends might be interested in a rematch.
Then that next year, we went into the fairgrounds on Wednesday evening and sought them out with a soccer ball, said, tomorrow night, Thursday.
And ever since, the residents of Sandwich, USA have played a single soccer game against the residents of Veracruz, Mexico. They start at 5 and play until dark. Most of the players on both sides remain the same. On the field, they help each other up, smile, pat each other's backs, and laugh together. But the language barrier is tough. An injury prevents Sandwich resident Kitty Green from playing this year. Frustrated, she watches from a cautiously distant hill, not quite hiding, but not yet arrived.
Well, I hurt my knee 2 weeks ago playing soccer. It's heartbreaking, but I mean, this is our only game that we play. We always just play amongst ourselves, you know, pick up. So this is the only time we have any other competition, which is good and bad.
This is how you measure yourself against the world.
Yeah, we call it the World Cup game.
Charlie the Fisherman, as everyone calls him, runs the water gun game during the fair. The lone gringo stands on the sidelines with 15 or so of his cheering Mexican co-workers. Last year, he played goalie. But this year...
No, they fired me.
What?
My amigos fired me. And they're all, yeah. This is the only time they come out of their our work and then enjoy themselves for the 6 months. So, I mean, they play a lot. They practice a lot, trust me. But this is what they look for every year. This is a good game, I'm telling you. Both sides are just as equal. Nice. Nice. I'm telling you, I'm serious. These guys are good, too.
In the darkness and with only a few minutes left and the score tied at 6, injured Kitty Green is drawn to the sidelines.
This is the second year that we're going to have a potluck dinner afterwards. So inviting all of them to come and we provide dinner. So we just feel like we just appreciate the game so much, you know, and we're so psyched. We appreciate all the work they do in the fair, and we're just like so psyched that they can come out and play soccer with us, you know, and kind of have a slice of regular life, you know. So we just wanted to keep going. So it's like, let's have dinner together. Come on, you know.
Is this hard for these guys to be away from home for 6 months?
Yeah. They are missing. They miss the family and kids.
When you travel to other towns, do you have any kind of similar experiences?
No, just here, yeah. I like it.
It seems like it would be.
I had to get interviewed, too.
She forced
Sorry,
me.
Sorry, Ali.
It's okay.
Yeah.
Ashley from Sandwich wraps her arms around Ali from Veracruz. Both smile in the dark. The first 2 years, the Mexicans didn't bring cleats. Now they come prepared. 2 years ago, the potluck dinner was added. This year, Leo Green bought a special glowing neon ball so they could play deeper into the night. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sean Hurley.
To see a photo of the Sandwich soccer team and their worldly competitors, you can go to wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, Lady Lamb the Beekeeper performs a few songs when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
I cannot think of that song with this music on. And I never want to go back to Arkansas.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we're listening to the song Regarding Ascending the Stairs by Lady Lamb the Beekeeper from her debut studio album, Ripely Pine.
I'm your apple.
The moniker Lady Lamb the Beekeeper came to Maynor Ali Spaltro in a dream and has since been popping up on marquees up and down the East Coast, not to mention online, where we read reviews of her captivating, almost spellbinding live performances and steady output of original, idiosyncratic music that we're calling a mix between Feist and Nirvana. Ripely Pine is her first studio album and has already been featured by Time Magazine and NPR, setting Lady Lamb well on her way to becoming a national name. She's here to play some songs live for us and to talk with us a little. So, Ali, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Now, musicians don't usually like it when we say cross of this person and, you know, it's like the Beatles had brunch with the Beach Boys and then, you know, had a date afterwards with Patti Smith. What do you think? Feist and Nirvana?
I love that. I think it's fascinating, and I'm very flattered by that comparison for sure.
We know that Bon Iver had his Cabin in the Woods and Kanye West apparently rapped, you know, with his jaws wired shut. Your origin lore begins in the basement of a video store in Maine. Can you tell us a little bit about it? Is that a true story?
It's a true story. I come from Brunswick, Maine. I worked for 4 years at an independent DVD rental store called Barton Gregg's in my hometown right on the main street. Instead of going to college, I accidentally started playing music there and became so invested that I just ended up staying there for 4 years. And I really loved working there. I love film. And it happened to be in a basement, so I was able to write songs and record and be loud after hours. I worked the closing shift, and I would pull out my gear from behind a wall and just make music all night.
Well, the name of the band came to you in your sleep. Do you get a lot of your ideas from dreams?
I do. A lot of the material on this record actually is directly inspired by dreams. I tend to write after a dream when I wake up. If it really got to me, I'll write it down pretty immediately. And then within those keywords come the lyrics.
Well, let's hear from the new record, Ripely Pine. This song is called The Nothing, Part 2. And this is Lady Lamb the Beekeeper playing live for us in Studio D.
Choose to use is your heart? If even towards the harshest fate that it may be swallowed, a masticated, mistaken thing that you may ripely pine in the mammoth nothing of the night, left to your own devices and to exhaust it.
The Nothing Part 2. Lady Lamb, the Beekeeper, played that live for us in Studio D here at New Hampshire Public Radio. Lady Lamb, the Beekeeper, is the band name of Ollie Spaltro, and she's with us talking a little bit about her new record, which is called Ripely Pine. What does it mean to ripely pine?
To me, it means to long for something with a pulpy heart. Really, that's where that comes from. And it's directly out of a lyric from that song, The Nothing Part 2,
yeah,
on the album.
I noticed that. Well, I know you were around 18 or 19 years old when you wrote most of the songs on this record. Where were you internally at that time?
I was exactly where I think every 18-year-old kid is at. I just found a way to express it. You know, at that age, you're so dramatic and everything is just this massive issue and heartbreak is everywhere and everything's a sign, and I just found a way to put it into words what I think we all feel when we're that age, and that's where the songs came from.
Hearing them live, watching you perform them in the studio, I was thinking about how sort of cinematic some of them are, and I just wonder, I mean, you must have been working all day watching DVDs, watching great films, and then making music. Do you think that came across?
Life. Absolutely. That was my life, was music and film, and they definitely became interspersed.
Which is fascinating because so many reviewers who write about your live performances, you know, one of them says it was one of those situations where you could have heard a pin drop, that everybody was so intensely focused on you and you had your eyes closed. Is this cinematic image, are these playing in the back of your eyelids when it's happening?
They are. To this day, these songs certainly have a visual for me, and I'm there in the movie.
Let's hear more from the new record. This is the song Between Two Trees. This is Lady Lamb the Beekeeper, recorded live from Studio D here at New Hampshire Public Radio.
Get a pillow till it makes you tired. Bummed out my whole pack and I gave my fire, all my fire. Emptied my pockets, these empty pockets. Emptied my pockets and I waited for your call. Laid on the pavement, down on the pavement, laid on the pavement with my ear against the wall. Stood on the mountain, up on the mountain, stood on the mountain and I called.
Song Between Two Trees. I hear that lyric and you say, my wrists are bound, I am the boat on your dock. That's such a main image.
It sure is.
Right? Stuck.
Yeah.
Just stuck there. And I wonder, now you live in Brooklyn, no longer in Maine, has that changed your approach to songs? I mean, your whole field of vision must be so different.
It, interestingly for me, has changed the way that I sing in terms of not having a practice space now in Brooklyn at the moment. So finding clever ways to write music and not make too much noise. So whereas, in Maine I could be really loud in the basement with an electric guitar, now I'm sitting on my bed with an acoustic guitar, which has opened up, I found my range, and I've noticed that I can sing different ways I didn't know that I could, which has been a great thing to learn.
I will bury you between two trees. I will bury you with me.
You do get to a lot of places. I mean, emotionally, there's quite a range. There's a rawness, there's screaming. Sometimes there's maniacal kind of laughing in the songs, almost a kind of crying. You really put yourself out there emotionally. Do you think that's something that you might regret in a few years' time?
No, because I feel really that the record and the music I make is coming from such an earnest place, and that's so important to me. And that's the way that I know how to make art. And so I think I'll continue to just be myself and be raw and honest as much as I can.
In all of your press photos, you look like you're having fun. You're surrounded by different flavors of pie, eating them with your hands. In your music video for The Nothing Part 2, which we heard earlier, you kidnap a bunch of people and force them to eat pie. So what is this fascination with pie?
I personally love pie. It's one of my favorite things. And on a rainy day, I like to just go get a slice of pie. And also, the album title reminds me of pie, Ripely Pine. I love to eat, and I thought it would be fun to get messy and let them be part of the album visual.
Well, here, let's leave listeners with the deep, dark color of a nicely cooked blueberry pie. This is the song Aubergine, performed by Ali Spaltro, Lady Lamb, the beekeeper. Ali, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, I bled blue blood from my back. Last night I was alone. Oh, aubergine sheets on my bed now. Oh, no. And your blue eyes light just like an atlas in the sockets. Yeah, your blue eyes cry map water when you're sorry. Oh, so sorry.
Ali Spaltro is Lady Lamb the Beekeeper. Her debut studio album is called Ripely Pine. You can find more on where Ali is touring and watch video of her live performance here in NHBR Studio D on our Facebook page or at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today. We do invite you to join in Word of Mouth's mission to spread new ideas. You can post links to segments on your Facebook page, you can retweet things you heard to your followers, or email segments to your friends. I'm Virginia Prescott. You can catch Word of Mouth online anytime at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby, Zach Nugent,
and Bill Barry.
And senior producer Rebecca Lavoie.
Sarah Plord is our digital producer.
And Dan Colgan runs our board. The views expressed in this program
are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR, its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows, go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook and Tumblr.
Follow us on Twitter.
And check out a playlist of music from the program
on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public
Radio.
My gaze, you with the tongue that speaks my name, you.